All right, good afternoon to everybody. We're just about to start the class. We'll just do a brief sound check just to make sure that the audio is being picked up by everybody who's joining us today. And once you hear the audio, just type audio okay at the bottom of the screen. Start of the class, we do a brief audio check, so we just take a few moments. Today we'll have a little bit of a Q&A session. We'll wait for a few more moments, let other people log on. All right, so we'll just start momentarily. And again, once you hear the audio, just type in audio okay at the bottom of your screen. Questions. We'll start today with the Q&A session. So if you have any questions, feel free right now to type them on screen. And we'll take up, as we were doing last week, we had a question and answer session. So we'll do that again today as well. And I get to see Robert, Chad in Florida, Michael in Florida, Gregory in Seattle. Okay, Chad, thanks. Gregory in Seattle, thank you. Michael in Florida, okay, thanks. Okay, we were a little late in getting out the notice today, so we'll just maybe wait a few more moments, but if you do have any questions, type them on screen. I'm not sure if some of you were here last week for the class. And we'll take up... But once we're done with the questions, we'll take up today's this week's parsha, Parshas Re'eh. Very interesting parshas in Devarim, in Deuteronomy. And we'll probably be working from the end of chapter 12 and also the beginning of 13. It's Devarim, Yud Beis, and Yud Gimel. Want to look at any specific psukim right now, any verses, you can take a look at 13, 4, and 5. And good to see Jonathan in Texas. Again, we'll have any questions you have, we'll take up at this point. And then we're going to just take just a few verses in this week's Parshas Re'eh. And again, once you have the audio, you just type an audio okay at the bottom. And Michael in Florida is asking, can we finish the question from last week about the death of the generation in the wilderness? Okay, Michael, why don't you type the question on screen? And this way I can see exactly what the specific question was. We're also doing now is if you'd rather be calling in, you can also call in with the question. That would be fine as well. The number is, I'll put it on screen here so you can all see. If that's easier. So you can either call or IM, whichever is preferable. Okay, so if you'd like, you can type it on the screen, Michael, or you can call in. Okay, so you're writing on screen. Okay, regarding whether the men or the women. It appears to me that the women died as well. The whole generation was the one that was crying, and that's why they deserve to be killed in the desert. I mean, not initially, in one fell swoop at that moment. But it does say that everybody, the whole congregation, all the B'nai Israel, were crying with fear as the spies had incited in them this feeling that they cannot conquer all the inhabitants of Canaan. God said that they could. The spies could not come to that, acceptance. So they didn't want to be the only ones that were complaining, so they incited a riot very subtly, and they get all the Jews to feel that they're going to be devoured by the inhabitants. So they all rebelled against God, and because of the rebellion, they were not entitled to get the land. So it appears to me there's women as well. I did not see anything outright that said that the women were spared. But was there a deeper question behind that, or was it just factual, Michael? Okay, Gregory in Seattle is saying, but how could Moshe Rabbeinu not go into the land? He was the most righteous individual. It's true, but not every righteous individual, King Solomon said it himself. He says that, ki ein adam tzadik ba'aretz she'asa tov lo yechta. There's no man that is righteous in the land that does good and doesn't sin. Okay, so, yes, Michael, the text seems to support, but unless you have something which outright says the women, did not get killed in the wilderness all those years. I mean, I'd like to see that. I never heard of that. Not saying you're wrong, but I just didn't, hear that angle before. Okay, thanks, Zachariah. And Laura in New York, nice to see you. But it is interesting, that verse itself that King Solomon wrote, and this is, again, all divinely inspired, what we have in the writings of Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon. So what are the words? He says that, I was just thinking about this week, that he says, Ki ein adam tzadik ba'aretz, shiyasa tov lo yechta. Maybe you could tell me which word you think is extraneous in this verse. I'll translate it. It says, for there is no man who is righteous in the land who does good and doesn't sin. Yes, Gregory, right. For there's no man that is righteous in the land that does good and doesn't sin. I think it's 7:3, 7:4, something like that in Koheles. There's no man that is righteous in the land that does good and doesn't sin. Which word seems a little extraneous in that verse? Again, I'll read it to you again. There is no man that is righteous in the land that does good and does not sin. You tell me which word is extraneous there. All right, first question for today's session. Michael, I saw what you sent by email. I didn't see anything that was absolute proof. It could be read that way, but I didn't see it as an absolute proof. If you have an absolute, proof that the women did not die, only the men, I'd like to see that, but unless I was missing something. All right, but I think this verse, think about this verse again. There is no man that is righteous in the land that does good and doesn't sin. And again, this is responding to, we just mentioned that about Moshe, yeah, Gregory in Seattle. You're saying that Moshe was so righteous. Why didn't he go into the land? Because not every, even though a person may be very righteous, but people do have errors. And because of one of Moshe's errors, he was not entitled to go into the land at that point. I believe if I remember correctly from what my teachers explained to me years ago, that his error by hitting the rock was an error in leadership. Therefore, his role of leadership was terminated early. And in terms of bringing them into the land. Okay, unless somebody has an idea, in terms of which word do you think is extraneous in this verse? There is no man that is righteous in the land that does good and does not sin. Which word do you not need in that verse? Okay, Zachariah in Mexico is saying, does good and does not sin seems redundant. No, because it's saying that there's no man who does good only. That's what it means. So that's not redundant. That would be as if he's saying, that King Solomon is saying, that Shlomo is saying that he does good and does not sin means to say that he does good only. That's the sense. Okay, so Chad in Florida is suggesting that does good is implied by the word righteous. Meaning, when it says there's no man that is righteous in the land who does good and doesn't sin. But that's not superfluous, because when it says righteous, it's first telling you that the title of the person. The perfection of this person is a righteous person. Now, it qualifies that by saying he does good and doesn't sin. That's just a qualification. It's not redundancy. That's now explaining what righteousness is. See, the whole purpose of this verse is that King Solomon is trying to explain to you that righteousness, well, what is righteousness? It's impossible that righteousness can go along without any sin. That would be an impossibility. The Talmud says this as well. Gemara says this as well. Okay, but there's another word. What about the word land? There's no man that is righteous in the land who does good and doesn't sin. Come on, that one's got to be something which you say, yeah, that's true. The word land would definitely be, you know, I think your choice as being more extraneous than your other ones, no? I mean, what does land have to do anything? What do you have to tell me? That there's no man that's righteous in the land? Well, where else is man going to live? What do you guys say about that? You tell me. Do you agree with my detection of a redundancy in this verse, or are you going to stick with yours? Do you think land is more extraneous? Okay, and for all those that just joined, just do us a favor and type audio okay in the bottom of the screen and hit enter. That'll just confirm that those of you who are joining now are picking up the sound okay. And as well, if anybody else is has been here from the beginning, you can type that as well, just to show that the stream is continued. Okay, I have one guy in my corner, Gregory agrees that the word land seems to be a little bit more extraneous than righteous or good. Because that makes sense. There's no man that is righteous in land who does good and doesn't sin, because that's explaining what righteousness is. What type of righteousness does Shlomo HaMelech say is possible? He says, well, the righteousness can't be one that's good without bad. So that makes sense. You have to say all those words. Okay, and welcome to Jonathan in Texas and Sarah in New York. Nice to see you all today. And again, we're taking questions. The questions can either be IM'd or you can call in. We'll put the number on screen again, since there's a lot of text going on. And once we're done with your questions, then I'll give you a question from this week's Parsha. Or just something that I saw yesterday. Okay, so Gregory agrees. And how about, let's see who else was talking here. Chad, you were making a statement also. You said, does good is implied by righteous. And if you do have any problem with the screen, sometimes you'll get an error message on screen. That's just in terms of connectivity. You can just hit your enter key. That'll bring you back to the screen. And Charles Vukovar, good to see you again, Charles. Okay, Chad in Florida is writing, when he says in the land, is he including the whole earth or just in the land of Israel? No, the earth, the whole globe. And for those of you that just joined in, we are discussing the verse in Koheles, in Ecclesiastes, where King Solomon says, there is no man that is righteous in the land that does sin, that does good and does not sin. There's no man that is so righteous that he does good and does not sin. So we're saying, what's the extra word land? There's no man that is righteous in the land. So the first question was, what was extraneous? Now we've come to some agreement that the word land seems to be out of place. What's the necessity for the word land? Okay, you tell me now. Now that we've uncovered a seeming redundancy, what do you think the answer might be? And Gregory is writing, if you do good just for the sake of gaining pride, it's sin. That would be sinful, unless you do it for the sake of doing good. Okay, I would agree with that, Gregory. But what do you think King Solomon is getting at by saying the word land? There's no man that is righteous in the land who does good and does not sin. What are we gaining by the word land? Okay, so Shad agrees, that makes sense, including the land is not necessary. Good, because where else does man live? So now we have to stop and think for a second. Well, what is the idea behind King Solomon putting in this word? So you tell me what you think. Okay, Lena, correct. We're talking about the earth. But why does King Solomon have to tell me that this idea that there's no man that is, he could have just written the verse like this. There's no man that is righteous, that does good and does not sin. What is he gaining by saying there's no man that is righteous in the land, meaning on earth, that does good and doesn't sin? What is he implying? What is the word earth? Being righteous on earth, where else are you going to be righteous? But there is some very important point that he's making. Okay. Jonathan in Texas is writing, if land means the whole earth, then he is pointing out that to all people. It's true, but there's no other place for man to live. Wouldn't we have the same exact idea without the word land? Chad is writing, once you die, you neither sin nor do good anymore in the land. Applies only to those living. Okay, that's true, in the land applies only to those living. Well, I mean, King Solomon is only speaking to those that are living. So again, I don't see what he gains by saying the word land. Zachariah, you're saying no man alive. Okay, but what are we gaining? Gregory writes, he says land to infer man, and man is the only creature capable of doing both good and evil. Well, that doesn't make sense to me, Gregory, because who else would he be talking to? He's not talking to animals. He doesn't have to tell us that good and bad applies only to man. We know it only applies to man. All right, so what do you want to say? Emmy in Brooklyn, the topic is a verse by King Solomon that we are discussing. There's one word which seems to be extraneous, and the verse is that there is no man. He actually starts off with the word for. For there is no man that is righteous in the land that does good and does not sin. So we're asking why the word land is there. Okay. So let me suggest to you, unless anybody wants to think about it for another moment, why don't you take another moment or two, think about the question, all right, and if I don't see any responses, I'll suggest to you what I was thinking. But again, this when you see the answer, it just helps to give us appreciation that, you know, when something is written divinely, every word has to contribute to the idea. Jonathan, though, it's not talking just about how things were at that time, because these ideas that are part of the Torah span all generations. Something which is true, absolute truth, is not something which is subject to inaccuracy at any generation. Yeah, he's talking about human nature. So human nature... you're welcome, Emmy in Brooklyn, and welcome to Mark R. Nice to see you, Mark. Okay, so the idea is, I think, as follows. when King Solomon says that there's no man that is righteous in the land who does good and does not sin. So we're asking, why does he have to say the word land? He could have just written, there's no man that is righteous that does good and doesn't sin. That gets the point across. He's trying to tell you that nobody's perfect. Everybody makes mistakes. We have instincts. This is God's will that we have them. We should use them properly. But the instincts have a head start. It was actually a nice idea. I went to a bris this morning, and there was a nice idea that the father stated. He was saying that the one of the blessings that you say at the bris, at the circumcision, is that alludes to Isaac. So Isaac wasn't the first one that was commanded in bris. It was his father, Abraham. Glad to see you here, Mark. Thank you. He asked the question, like, what is the significance of the son of Abraham with the bris? The bris was initially given to Abraham. Nobody had the command of circumcision until Abraham. He perfected himself. He raised himself, you know, he extricated himself from idolatry. And what his mind pondered from the very young age of 3 or 4, whatever it was, until he was 40, when he finally concretized his ideas about God. And eventually God related to him in prophecy, and he gave him command in circumcision. Now, Abraham is the one that's the whole founding father of Judaism and the first one commanded in circumcision. And we do have a blessing at a bris that deals with, it says, L'hachnisno, the bris shel Avraham Avinu, that the father makes the bracha, the blessing, that he's entering his son into the bris, the treaty of Abraham, which is correct, because Abraham was the one who received the whole, he was the first one that God gave bris to. It wasn't Noah before him, and it wasn't Yitzchak after him. It was Abraham. It was Abraham. So if that's true, that Abraham is the one that God initiated bris with, so why do we have another statement during the bris that talks about Isaac? So he said a very nice idea. See, when Abraham had the bris, he was 99. He was very old. And I believe he was 99. Correct me if I'm wrong. But what happened was that he had at a very late age. However, Yitzchak, Isaac, his son, had the bris at the right time. Because now, once he had the institution, he had the command from God. So when he had his son later on, so at 8 days old, Abraham circumcised Isaac. But Isaac now had a separate benefit which Abraham did not have. All right? What was the benefit that Isaac had, that Yitzchak had? The benefit that Yitzchak had, that, you know, this is my friend, the Rabbi Reuben Gober said this. He said that Isaac benefited from having circumcision from the right moment, right at birth, right, you know, after he's strong enough, at the 8th day, which Abraham did not have. So therefore, Abraham's life was compromised to an extent by not having that limit on the sexual, which is the whole concept of bris. However, Isaac did. Isaac had the tempered mitzvah, the mitzvah which tempers the human instincts, from the right age, from the age of 8 days old. So he benefited in a greater way, much greater way than Abraham. Therefore, he was the first person that really embodied bris in its fullest expression. So this way, when a child from youth now has the bris from that young age, and God's wisdom decrees that it should be at that point, therefore you benefit much more, because now the instincts are that much more tempered from youth. Okay, so it was a nice idea. Now, what does that have to do with what I was mentioning? Let me think. What was the idea we were saying here? Yeah, we were talking about King Solomon's words. Let me just see. There's a question on screen. All right, Alberto, thanks for the digital humor there. Emmy in Brooklyn. Could we say the Torah is a safeguard from evil? So the land, which we're referring to in this quote, and I'll just say the quote one more time, there's no man righteous in the land that does good and does not sin. So the word land, what does it mean? There's no man that is righteous in the land that does good and does not sin. So, Emmy in Brooklyn is saying the word land, which refers to non-Torah matters, is stating that whoever doesn't occupy himself with Torah matters will not be safeguarded. I don't see that from the words. All right, nice to see you, Dango, in Edmonton, I guess, Canada, and Alan in New York. Yeah, I think the idea is like this. See, King Solomon is telling us that land has something to do with sin. Let me just start off with the first step, and you tell me if you hear what I'm saying. Meaning that King Solomon is suggesting that there's no man that can be righteous in the land and not sin. Meaning once man is in the land, which of course every man and woman live in the land, meaning the globe, the earth. He's not just talking about Israel, he's talking about the entire earth. But this experience that we have when we're alive on earth, this interrelation with the earth causes some sin. It's impossible. The question is how. All right, so this is the first step I'm making. You see now if you can answer what I'm saying. You tell me now if you see the direction I'm going. All right, Mark, you got that? Okay, and Bob in Connecticut, nice to see you. Neil, nice to see you too. What I'll do is we'll just type the verse on screen because I think people will ask what we're discussing. Okay, I just put that on screen so you can take a look. And I just put in the quotes, the word, the land. That's the question that we have. Okay, so for those of you that just joined. Okay, so Mark is writing, we are not perfect, so we have freedom of choice, right? In the land, okay. Let's see a few other entries. And good to see Neil, and good to see David in Detroit. Emmy in Brooklyn saying vanity. Well, I don't see where that is tied in with the land. Jonathan in Texas is writing, in the land with status, so there wouldn't be any question about what people he was talking about. I disagree. I don't see where you're getting that from the words. Mark R., choice to make your own decisions. I'm not sure where you're getting that from. Gregory in Seattle is writing, the land is the source of what motivates us to sin. Okay, good. How is that, Gregory? All things for which we lust come from the land, from the soil. You'll have to elaborate on that. Okay. But like I said, and which you're agreeing with, Gregory, is that the land is the source of what motivates us to sin. And what does that mean? See, I think what he means is that the human existence, which is a physical existence, is sensory, is something which is going to lead a person to sin. So King Solomon is giving that idea by just saying there's no man who is righteous in the land. Meaning in the land is something which, in terms of whether it's harvesting for food, the need, the whole life of man, the whole spectrum of interests and needs and pleasures and wants and desires is bound up with the physical. And it's a double-edged sword because on the one hand we need the physical, we need sustenance, we need homes, we need clothing, we need friends, we need relationships. On the other hand, the emotions tend to not tend, but they do have a head start. Intelligence does not form until a child is 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Finally, at 13, the child can now take on his own responsibility. He becomes bar mitzvah, which means now obligated in law. Until that point, he's not obligated because the mind just does not have the ability to control him. So he can't be culpable for sin. He can't be commanded yet. Of course, we train the child as young as we can, but the instincts have a head start. Now, this head start is something which is based on all the everything in our physical life. So King Solomon is basically saying this idea by saying in the land. Okay, you tell me if you agree with that or not. And hello to Jonathan in Arizona, Brad in Utah, and Abe in Florida. Good to see you. All right, so we're just taking one point so far. But I think that idea that Rabbi Reuben Goldberg mentioned was very good. That they, it's true that Abraham was the first one to have circumcision. However, his son Isaac was the first one to have it from the right time, meaning from youth. In order to head off the instincts at youth, the child has circumcision at 8 days. 8 days old, that's when you express. I mean, the idea behind that also is that a human being is not complete. I mean, even though we're born naturally with the foreskin, but that is not the goal that God wants. God did not just make a human being just physically. We're the only beings that have intelligence. And to demonstrate that our life is to be one where intelligence is to be the focal point, and the emotions are there to assist us and to have a good, pleasurable life, but to aid us in that life, we show that the greatest drive, the sexual, is something which is tempered by the act of circumcision. Maimonides says that a man who has circumcision does not have as much pleasure in the sexual act as a man who doesn't. And he also says that a woman who had intercourse with a man who is uncircumcised would not be able to be satisfied by a man who is circumcised. So that means both genders derive greater sensual enjoyment when the man is not circumcised. So we see, according to Maimonides, that the circumcision is for the purpose of not removing, but diminishing the sexual drive. So this is necessary if a person is going to be living a life of wisdom. So we also have the appetitive drive, the appetite. There also we have control. Certain foods we can have, certain foods we cannot have. And what's very interesting, is a nice idea, is that there are... let me just see a couple of notes over here. By working land, it is possible to forget God because he occupied us with the same thing. Okay, true. Emmy in Brooklyn, Zachariah saying, if we're involved in physical life, we are bound to sin. True. Okay. Okay, Alberto Gorin, you may want to take a look at last week's Jewish Times. I actually did an article on creation and intelligence, which is addressing your point about animals being intelligent, which is not true. But take a look at it. It's the last page of the last week's Jewish Times. If you want to take a look at the Jewish Times after we're done with the class today, you'll see the link. It's the sixth link down on the left-hand side, the white links on the parchment paper. You'll see that on the left-hand side of your screen. So you can take a look at the Jewish Times. Last week was issue number 175. So you can take a look at that. But the idea over here now, getting back to the drives, is that there. You should think about this for a second. And this is probably something which I don't know if you've heard before, but you have laws that govern the sexual and the appetite. And those, psychologists will tell you, are the two basic drives, the two most powerful drives. But the laws are not only telling you you can't have this woman or man or you can't have this food, absolutely, but then there are some laws that say this you can't have now, but later you can. Or this you can't have today, but this you can have tomorrow. Or you have to wait a few hours. Meaning the laws are constructed in two realms. One realm of limitation is absolute limitation. Like, for example, pork. That's absolutely prohibited. All right? But even pork would be permitted if you're at war or if you have nothing to eat and you're going to die. There, of course, there are, you know, life is something which is, we even break the Sabbath for that. Certainly we would allow a person to eat something not kosher to save their life. Okay, and hello to Don in, I guess it's South Carolina, and Mitch Menchel. Good to see you. Recognize your name, Mitch. Hope everything is good. Now, the idea we're talking about is that in both the areas of prohibition for the sexual and for the appetitive, eating. So we have the idea that, number one, there are certain things that are absolutely prohibited, which, you know, pork is a good example, or a person who's not Jewish, or a sister or a mother, all right? So there are certain people or objects that we relate to that are completely prohibited in certain areas. All right, whether it be sexual or whether there are objects that are completely prohibited, like pork. But then you have ideas like milk and meat, meaning to say you can have kosher meat and you can have kosher milk. However, if you just had meat, the milk is now prohibited to you for, usually it's, 6 hours for most people, depending on your custom. So what is the idea behind this? Why do we have... It's interesting to see how God structured the laws. And again, the laws have to reflect human nature. So when we see laws, we always have to ask, well, what is this? How is this perfecting us? In what way? Okay, so that's what I'd like to pose to all of you now. If you want to think about the question, what is the idea that we have two types of prohibition? One type of prohibition is called an absolute prohibition, where an object is always going to be prohibited, you know, for the duration of your life in, you know, normal circumstances. So that's one type of prohibition. Why? And then we also have that coupled with other prohibitions, which are not always. They're, you know, situational. They're conditional prohibitions. For example, having milk after you ate meat. So there's nothing inherently wrong or prohibited about the meat, and there's nothing prohibited about the milk. It's just that in certain combinations, we don't have it, and that's based on certain idolatrous practices that they used to do. We don't have to get into that right now. But what I want you to focus on is that there are two types, all right? That there are two types of prohibition. Okay, so let's make sure that everybody has the question clear. I'm asking about the two types of prohibition. If everybody has it, just type, you know, okay on screen. This way I get some feedback that you hear the question clear. And let me just wait for a moment for you to type that. And then we'll move on to your possibilities. All right, Alan, thanks. Jonathan, Texas. Don, South Carolina. Gregory, thank you. Charles Vukovar. Abe in Florida, thank you. Chad, Michael in Florida. Lena, Jonathan, Arizona. And Dr. Tony. Okay. That's right, doctor. That's right. But even that, where does that come from? Okay. And Zachariah, thanks. Mitch, Michelle, good. Okay, so the question's clear. All right, now think about the question. Why do we have two types of prohibitions? Very interesting question. And for every interesting question, there's an interesting answer. So, but the learning really it comes from the questions. So think about that for a few moments. And if you have an idea, feel free to type it on the screen. But it's not a simple question. All right, Jonathan in Texas is writing, the prohibitions are geared towards two different aspects of discipline. Okay, why don't you elaborate, Jonathan? And Lena is writing, some things are maybe forgiven. I don't understand that statement. Jonathan, you're right. Definitely gearing towards two types. All right. Gregory's writing. One is a prohibition against cruelty, mixing milk with meat. Well, I don't see why that has to be cruel. You can kill the animal properly without pain. And the other is against things we lust, prohibited foods. All right. So you're saying something is about cruelty and something about lust. All right. It's not really getting to the idea in general. You're sticking to the area of food when, well, you're saying there's, I guess you'll say there's lust also. But, you know, these are basically desires anyway. So we're talking about desires. So I don't, you really have to stay within that sphere. So even within the sphere of desire, we have to answer the question. I think you're trying to go outside that sphere by saying it's lust and something else. Some are absolutely wrong. I agree, Lena, that's true. Jonathan's writing, do not eat pork, period. That's true. I don't see how that answers the question, John. Chad is writing, some things are prohibited absolutely because they are absolutely detrimental to us. Some are only detrimental in some ways and must be used only in the right way. That's not the reason why things are detrimental. Well, let me take that back. They are detrimental. I don't know from the way you mean, but the question is, what are the two different types of detriments? Okay, that's what we have to get down to here. Mark is right. Prohibition is a tool to better yourself. The question is, why do we have two different types of prohibitions? We have number one, absolute prohibition. Certain things are always prohibited. Number two, we have conditional prohibitions. Things may be permissible now, but if I ate meat, I could not have this cheese right now. Okay. A lot of you are answering specifics. Why milk and meat together? Boiling a kid in its mother's milk is cruel. That's not answering the question. Michael in Florida is writing, does this have to do with the idea that some things are always prohibited, but other things transition from prohibited to allowed and then back again, like Nida? That's exactly what we're discussing. The question is, why do we have these two types of prohibitions? Dr. Tony, no, they are not tests of faith. Judaism doesn't have tests of faith. In that sense, I mean, there are things that we have trust in God for sure. But mitzvos, commands, have to make sense. The whole purpose of command is that it appeals to our mind and we see how it benefits us. Okay, Abe is writing spiritual and physical. Okay, that definitely I agree with that. It conditions you both, but I think there's more to it than that. Alan New York is writing because God said so within his Torah. It's the Creator's manual. How can we argue? We're not about to argue, Alan. We are trying to understand the design of God's Torah, which is the whole reason he gave us intelligence. Dr. Tony is writing, if you can discipline yourself in these, then you can work to better discipline yourself in other areas. True. But then again, the question would be, it would return. So why discipline ourselves in other areas? The question you're not answering, nobody's answering. What is the idea that we have absolute prohibitions and also conditional prohibitions? That's the question we're dealing with. We have your sister and your mother and your brother and your father, you cannot marry. That's an absolute prohibition. Conditional would be if somebody is single, you can marry her. If she's married, you cannot. That would be a conditional. And you have that in food as well. You cannot eat pork ever. That's absolute. Conditional is that you can have milk, but you cannot have it till 6 hours after you ate meat. The question we're asking again, what is the concept behind having both absolute and conditional prohibitions? Think about it. Think about it. And hi to Rich and hi to Gene in Missouri, Alex in Mexico. Long time no see, Alex. I hope you're doing well. And Rivka, hello to you. And Alan to New York. How are you doing? I'll give you an analogy. What would be easier for anybody here? I don't know if anybody here smokes or not, but if you have smoked, or if you could think about somebody who smokes, what would be easier or more difficult for the person? To quit cold turkey? To just stop that way and not have another cigarette? Or to maybe go from 2 packs a day to only 2 cigarettes a day? What do you think would be more difficult? Jonathan, no. Only one of them is absolute. All right, the other ones are not because they're conditionally prohibited. But think about the question I just posed to you. What would be more difficult or more easy? All right. Well, actually, it's the same question. A person to quit from smoking 2 packs a day to nothing at all, or to only smoke 2 cigarettes a day. Okay, Lena, you're saying to lower the amount that you smoke is harder. I agree with you. Explain, Lena. Tell me why. Okay, Abe is saying to quit cold turkey is more difficult. Okay, give me your reason, Abe. And Richard is saying two cigs a day to smoke less, gradual quitter. Okay. All right, so most of you saying to lower it down. It still occupies you. Okay, good, Lena. It still occupies you. Keep going and elaborate more, Lena. What do you mean it still occupies you? You got it. I just want you to articulate it. You have the answer. Okay, Alberto was suggesting that the stop smoking is hard, from two packs to nothing at all. It is impossible. It needs to slow building it off. Okay, so Alberto was saying you have to slowly do it. Well, I've seen plenty of people that stop cold. Okay, Gregory is writing, you still have a desire to reach out and smoke. Jonathan's writing, we're told that we can eat meat and consume milk, but the conditions are imposed as to when. Yes, that's true, Jonathan, I agree. Okay, but Lena, I want Lena now to just to articulate a little bit better. She said it very well. Okay, Alberta, it's true. Let me just wait, though. I want to see what Lena wants to write down there. Okay, Gregory, when you're saying a person has to reach out and smoke, is that because he stopped completely or he tapered off? Okay, and Lena is suggesting you are still busy with the smoking, the amount. Little thoughts that keeps the smoking in your mind. And Alan is saying the same thing as Lena. If you quit completely, then you lose all ties to the smoking. Good. Okay, so it may be that... good, Gregory, right. If you taper it off, it would be difficult, right. So what does it show you? It shows you exactly like Lena had started saying. And Gregory as well, and Alan. That the emotions are designed, there's one aspect of the design of the emotions, that an attachment that still exists will keep the emotion more alive. So if I only taper it off to two cigarettes a day, it's still giving satisfaction and it is aggravating, which means exciting the emotion. The rabbis say regarding the sexual drive that if you starve it, it becomes full. But if you feed the sexual drive, then it gets hungry. Which means the more you give in to the sexual drive, and this applies to other drives too, so the more you feed it, the more you're going to want. The more you get agitated, the more you are engaged in that need for the emotion. It's like taking drugs. People take a little bit at first. It's enough to get them high, but then the body acclimates, and then you need larger dosages. And same thing with cigarette smoking. Initially, a couple of cigarettes a day would be enough to give you that rush to the throat, whatever the feeling is. But then you need more, because then the cilia in your throat becomes a little bit numb, and maybe just the throat itself becomes numb to the cigarette. You need a more powerful cigarette, or you need cigarettes more often. And drinkers do the same thing. So you see that there's a design in the emotions that if you withdraw from the emotion, the need to satisfy the emotion weakens. So if you completely quit the smoking, so then the tie is broken, like Lena said. Okay? So you see that by having a little bit now and a little later, you know, you have two cigarettes now, it may drive you to go back because now you're still satisfying the emotion. Where if you had completely, you know, removed from it, so then that would be maybe a more difficult thing to go through because now you're not satisfying yourself at all at the beginning, but in the long term, since you're distant from it, it's less of an attraction. So that's why I believe we have the two different types of prohibitions that God gave us, because God designed the emotions in a way where he knows that the emotions work in at least two different ways. One way is that it needs to be tempered in terms of a controlled manner. What do you mean by controlled? That you can have something but in a controlled manner. You can have milk, but you can't have it after meat. So I have to control when I can have this object. It's sort of like having a few cigarettes a day. I can have the milk, but not right now. I can have the cheese, but not right now. Or I have to fast certain days. So I'm constantly, consciously manipulating my activities. I'm gauging what I'm going to eat and when I'm going to eat. So the mind is actively involved in the process. But then there are certain things that, for whatever reason, God decided that pork and other foods, there has to be an absolute withdrawal from them. So that's another type of control, where it's an absolute removal. So making that break and staying away from things absolutely, it gives a different control to the human body, and also to the mind, because you're now learning how to manage emotions in both ways, managing them absolutely and also conditionally. So what it does is it gives you full control, because let's say you only had one of them. Let's say I only had a bunch of laws about staying away from things absolutely. And that's all the Torah ever prohibited me in the sexual area, in the appetite, you know, eating, in any area, in stealing. Let's say the Torah only had absolutely, these are things, it was just a list of 613 things that you could never do. Well, the truth is you would never come to working with the emotions on a daily basis. You would just have a list of things that you carry around that can't have these. You'd never be involved with them, so there would be no attachment emotionally to them. So you would be losing out on the other area, which is having a little satisfaction and then withdrawing yourself. That perfects you in another way. It helps you to manage your emotions in a different way. Okay, and that's like Zachariah just wrote. It's easier to avoid something completely than to have it present always. That's true. Richard is saying, I gave it smoking, not looking to give up sex yet. Okay, very good, Richard. Alberto, as a kid, I tried after I stopped some feels. I'm not sure you're saying that. Like your problems go away from some. I'm not sure I get that clearly. And Jonathan is writing, you could have meat and milk, but develop the habit of having them when you can have them. That's right. You could develop certain controls. See, if for a child, you could imagine it would be very difficult to say you can have ice cream now, but in 1 hour you can't. I mean, the mind just isn't developed enough to really be able to control the emotions yet. But with training, then the mind can't start overtaking how the emotions react. And so you see that there are two ways that the emotions work. So when we look at, to answer our main question, you have different types of prohibitions because you have different types of perfections. That's based on our design. And every law that you will ever find in the Torah, you will be able to investigate to see, now, how is this going to perfect me in this area? How is that law going to perfect me in that area? That's what we have to do. We have to see what the beauty is behind it. It's not like somebody mentioned earlier today. It's a leap of faith. It's not just faith. Of course, you know that God's giving it to us for our own good. He created us. He created human beings to have a fantastic life. So, of course, everything he gives us in the Torah and allows us to choose to follow must be for our own good. Okay. All right. Jonathan's writing, thus there's two disciplines, one imposed by God, the second imposed by itself. No, they're both imposed by God. These all laws come from God. Okay. Gregory in Seattle is asking, if emotions are present in all humans, why are Gentiles not prohibited from absolute and conditional prohibitions? Well, I'm not sure that they don't have that. I mean, they have a minimum of seven laws, but keep in mind that the Gentiles have seven laws minimum to keep. If they want to keep more, they can definitely keep more, and they would perfect themselves just like us. You have to realize a Jew is no different than a Gentile. We all come from Abraham. We all come from Noah. So that means we're all the same exact human being. God decided at a certain point that the Torah had to be given. And you can see clearly, I mean, there's so many prohibitions against all the idolatrous cultures, everything which happened in Egypt, and then by Molech, sacrificing children over fire. I mean, such crazy and bizarre and insane practices had to be counted. God gave it to Torah, but he gave it to those who already expressed an allegiance to monotheism, which was Abraham and his offspring. But it's not that he's giving the Torah for us and they can't have it. No, we have the concept of a convert. But the concept of a Gentile only having seven laws is means to say that these are the minimum that you must keep if you want to be entitled to life. I'm not giving everybody the Torah because not everybody was ready for it. He gave it to the people that were ready. They, the ones, have to hold on to it and to teach the rest of the world. That's the Jews. Okay, so you have to understand that this concept of, that people have, that Gentiles and Jews are different, that, they don't have to, what Gregory's asking is a good question. So if you look into the laws that the Gentiles have, you will see that they have a certain minimum amount of perfection that is required in order that they deserve continued life. That's what the concept of the seven laws are. And those seven are seven out of the 613 that we have. But the it's not that we are not giving, God doesn't want the Gentile to have the good life. When he gave that system, he said, listen, there's two systems I'm giving right now. One system I'm giving, and keep in mind, God did not give the Torah until the year 2448. That means for the first 2400 years, God did not see that he had to give Torah to mankind. Evidently, all men were the same, and all men today are the same. But at a certain point in history, it was necessary, and God gave it. Was it his plan from the beginning to give the Torah at that point? Yes, he knew how mankind would unfold. God knew how history would unfold. I mean, that's clear. Okay. Let's see the other points over here. If people eat less when they smoke, then all smokers are skinny. No, maybe that's for some people, Richard. Everybody has different emotions, different compositions. Okay, so now, Lena, you're asking what this has to do with the land. Our initial question was, why does King Solomon say that? Let me just post it on screen because a number of people have just logged on, so this way everybody can see the verse again. Here we go. Okay, I just put it on screen in red so you can take a look again. The idea was that when King Solomon says, and you look, take a look on screen, the red type I just entered, there is no man who is righteous in the land who does good and does not sin. This means to say that the experience of man in the land is something which causes sin. Because King Solomon could have just written the verse that there is no man who is righteous who does good and does not sin. That would have been sufficient. But what he'd be leaving out is that where does a certain element of sin come from? It comes from our physical existence, being on earth, being in this earthly existence where we have instincts, we have needs, and we have emotions. And many times we allow our needs and wants in life to be, we overindulge. And that's against the system of the Torah. So even though it's necessary, that's what we have to gauge our emotions. We have to gauge, and that's what the whole system of the mitzvahs are to give us the accurate directions and how to live in every single area of life. So that's what it means that when King Solomon said, there's no man who is righteous in the land who doesn't sin. Why? The reason why it's impossible not to sin is because you're living in the land, because you're living in a physical existence. And this is something which is bound up inextricably with the emotions and desires. And it takes a lifetime sometimes to really perfect ourselves. Okay, now Gregory, you're writing, but if a Jew was raised in a Gentile culture, right, how can he immediately have responsible for the 613 laws? Well, God knows what to hold a person responsible for, and he knows when a person's able to, to change himself. So you may be very much like, a child in that respect. So, and God is merciful, so he's not going to hold the person responsible for that which he's not capable of doing yet. But now that you know about the Torah and you know about the system, now you're obligated in studying it. Richard is asking, why do many of the Gentiles know our Bible better than we do? Because they study it more. That's all. Lena is asking, sin is part of us. That's not true. That's the whole concept of the scapegoat that we're going to read about, in a month or so on Yom Kippur, where it says in the Torah that the high priest would confess the sins of the Jews. He had his hands on the scapegoat on Yom Kippur. He would confess the sins of the Jews, and then figuratively, the scapegoat would carry the sins of the Jews out to the desert, where they'd push the scapegoat off the cliffy mountain of Azazel. And before it even hit the desert floor from the peak of that mountain, the mountain was so sharp, the rocks were so sharp, that it carved up the scapegoat. But the idea that it's carrying the sins away, a rabbi once explained, meant to show you that sins are not part of us. And that's part of the whole repentance process, is when you realize that you don't have to sin. And it's not something integrally tied to you. So that knowledge that sin is not part of us is something which is very helpful. However, Christianity has the wrong idea. They have this idea of original sin, and something which they feel that every human being is born with sin, and you just need to have Jesus to forgive you, which is a ludicrous idea. It contradicts the very Bible that they're so good in quoting, Richard. Like you're saying, how come the Gentiles quote the Bible better than we do? Well, there's no reason they can't quote it better. If they study it more than you do, they will quote it better. However, they're not thinking, because the Bible, the Torah, says openly that ish b'cheto yumas, each man in his own sin will be killed. If that's true, their whole concept of Jesus dying for everybody else's sins is completely blasphemy. It's going against God's system. God said that each man in his own sin will be killed. There's a whole chapter, chapter 18 in Ezekiel, the book of Ezekiel, right? Yechezkel, that says it openly. It's in the Torah as well. Right. Yeah, Jesus can't do anything for you, especially when he's going against the system of the Torah. But Jews are afraid to speak out. And this is what's keeping a lot. I was talking to somebody who has a foundation. I think it's in Chicago or Miami. I'm not sure where it is. And the foundation, he's really anxious, very nice guy, and we're going to speak more. And he's trying to battle against the assimilation and intermarriage. Well, you're not going to be able to battle against it if the yeshivas and the schools today are not arming Jewish youth with clear understanding as to why all the other religions are false. If we don't teach them that, so then the missionaries and all these Jews of Jesus that are going around to get the Jewish youth, they'll be very successful. Because the Jewish children, the teenagers, and the collegiates, and the young adults are not being taught clearly what are the tenets of Judaism. Yeah, they're getting them to memorize Talmud, which is good, and Mishnah, and Chumash, and Parsha, the weekly portion, very nice, and they can speak Hebrew very fluently. But they're leaving school without having any idea as to what makes Judaism Judaism. It's a shame. And we actually did, if you want... I mean, all of you here today could be instrumental in helping to battle against, you know, these missionaries and intermarriage and assimilation. We put out last year in the summertime a series of issues of Jewish Times. They were from number 116 through 126. So about 10 consecutive issues in the Jewish Times, 116 through 126, deal with different aspects of analyzing the other religions, exposing their flaws, and showing how they're false. And we did it for quite a time. It would be very helpful if you would print these out and give them to people who are administrators in Hebrew day schools and yeshivas, give them to the teachers, give them to the rabbis, have them become very familiar. We did all the legwork already, and it's in print, and you can print as many as you want of them right from the site, and it's free. So do it. Let them be armed with the answers, so this way they could train their students and they could see how Christianity and Islam and these other and the Jews for Jesus and all these different cults, how they're completely wrong, how they're based on no proof, it's just blind faith, whereas Judaism is based on proof and sensibility and reason. So it's very important that we all do as much as we can to counter this. Unfortunately, many Jews and Jews that have a voice are afraid of making waves, and they make statements like, you know, the Christians are our friends and we have to make sure that they keep supporting us. You don't need Christian support. It's such a... I mean, what happened to God? Christians are stronger than God all of a sudden. I mean, a person's living the right life, you have guarantees in the Torah. If you're not sure about that, well, look outside your window, look at creation, look at your own hand. All right, these are all creations. That means they did not create themselves. Something had to create this world. Something had to create you and me today. This is God. And God gave us the Torah as well and gave us a sensible, reasonable, perfect system. No other religion has this. And this is something which Moses exclaimed to the people. Has God ever done this, where he took one nation from another nation with wars and with miracles and given him a system? And as he's done for you today, we just read this a few weeks ago. Right, Moses is reminding the people that we're the only ones. There was never a duplication of revelation at Sinai. There was never a time where God revealed himself to a nation. All the other religions are built on the words of one person who had some fantasy in his head. He goes around telling people, and everybody buys it. But no, Jews today are very meek, and they're weak, and they don't have the ability to speak out and to teach publicly in the schools that these religions are false. This is what you have to do. What are you afraid of? I'll give you something to be afraid of. Be afraid that your children will convert to Christianity. If that's not a big enough fear, I mean, I don't know what is, but to be afraid to follow God because you need Christian support, that's wrong. We're not here to coddle them. We're here to educate them. We're the ones that were given the system. They're the ones that bastardized the system and made it into some idolatrous cult. Now, I'm speaking strongly and harshly maybe to you today. I wouldn't speak this way with a person who is not religious or a Gentile or a Christian. I would speak in a way which I would try to really show them clearly and pleasantly that their ideas are false. But I would not mitigate my words. I would not compromise the ideas for the sake of needing Christian support. We don't need Christian support. You have God. So that's the biggest mistake Jews are making today. So that's why it was important. We took a stand, and some Jews wrote in and told us, you really shouldn't be doing this. And when we asked them, why shouldn't we be doing this? This is what God says we should be doing. This is what the whole system of Torah is about. That's countering at every single turn the, idolatry. And that's what the deification of Jesus is. Making Jesus into a god is idolatry. Period. Okay, let me just look on screen. I will have to wrap up the class in about 5 minutes. So if you have any questions, type them now. Let me just look. Looking at prohibitions from a restrictive standpoint of denial is from a negative stance. Can't do this, shouldn't do that. Okay, when we view this world as all part of God's plan, and we and everything in it is part of it, we can follow the mitzvot from joy, good, and transcend the negativity and view from a positive standpoint. That's right. When we see the ideas, we'll fulfill the mitzvot out of a joy. Well, they make sense to our mind. And we'll elevate ourselves spiritually, transcending the physical world, connecting with God. Excellent. Very good, Rivka. Gregory in Seattle is writing, all Jews will never become idolaters. The truth will remain always. No, there's plenty of Jews that have converted. Okay. And the truth is, when we don't approach the Christians and the other religions, and we don't teach them, it's wrong. We're keeping them in the dark. And that's a wrong thing, because they are God's creation, just like we are God's creation. So the truth is that it's the cruel thing to do, not to, to have this interfaith dialogue that people are doing. You should really have an interfaith debate. That's what you should have. You invite the Christians, come over to your home one night, have your coffee, have tea, have a nice get-together with your friends that are not Jewish, and start educating them. And they will see the ideas make sense. And there are many Christians that have left it because they saw the ideas makes no sense at all. Yes, Charles, we'll try to give more advanced notice on the class. But you were here from the beginning, Charles. I don't think you missed anything. But again, the classes are put online after we're done in the audio files link. So I'm glad you brought that up. Okay. And Alberto's writing, we have some insane that creates hate. No, the goal is not to create hate, but you have to tell them. I mean, if you know they're just not going to listen to you, all right. But, it's the right thing to do in terms of discussing with them in a nice way. I've done it. I've approached people that are not Jewish, not Christian. If I see they just start getting back off, they're just not going to listen. All right, there's nothing you can do. You try it. Okay. Charles is right. Okay, get that right. All right, so again, I would suggest that that'd be something that we all take a part in, and that, again, the issues in the Jewish Times are 116 through 126. Feel free to print them out, give them to the people who are in the position that they can educate others, use them yourself, understand where the flaws are. And we shouldn't be cowering. There's nothing to be afraid of. If they don't agree, so they don't agree. But there's a chance that they will see the ideas if you explain it to them. Okay. All right. So that's all right. So we'll wrap it up over here at that point. I hope everything was clear in terms of the different types of prohibitions. It shows us how we have different ways the emotions have to be managed because we have different types of emotions. So they have to address both types of emotions. All right. If a person was just completely off limits to everything, so he would never know how to react when, in a situation, his emotions would just be like a hot and cold type of personality. he wouldn't be able to work with things with his mind because he never engaged the mind. Just staying away from something absolutely is one type of perfection, but it's not complete perfection. That's why you need it. You need to have the prohibitions that are sometimes permitted, sometimes prohibited. It helps that other part of the emotions. And we also see King Solomon's words that there's no man that is righteous in the land who does good and doesn't sin. Meaning to say that the existence, our whole existence in the physical world is something which is a double-edged sword. We have emotions, we have needs, we have to live a physical life. We need to have homes, clothing, food. All this engaging in the physical, sometimes we get a little bit too involved and we try to put away too much money and we forget and we lose sight of what the real goal is. There's only Dennis in Wisconsin. There's only one issue, 116. I mean, all the issues you'll see are numbered. Okay? So we started 4 years ago with issue number one, and today we're up to issue 175. So you'll see the numbers are on there. Just click on the number, 116 through 126, and look at the ones that interest you and the things that will help you, and give them to other people. Let them start educating themselves on the understanding of what is Islam all about. How did it get started? What is Christianity? What is Buddhism? We did an issue on that. That's one of those issues. Okay, I think right in the beginning of those issues. All right, so at this point, my pleasure, Dennis. Okay, so at this point, we're going to wrap up the class. Any questions, feel free to email them in to the site. You see the little envelope icon on the bottom of the white links on your left-hand side. That's how you can email us, and we will keep you posted. Hopefully, again, Charles, you're asking to give you a more advanced notice for the classes. But again, we will keep the schedule updated. So, for those of you that like attending the classes, you should regularly visit the live classes link. This way, you can see what the schedule is and just jot that down somewhere. Okay, Chad, my pleasure. I'm glad you enjoyed the class today. I'm glad everybody came. Hope everybody enjoyed, and we'll see you next time. So have a good week, and keep take a look at the live classes link. You'll see when the next class will be posted. And again, for those of you who missed any part, this is recorded in full, and it will be on the audio files link shortly after the class is over, and you'll be able to hear it, completely. Okay, Alberto, good to see you. Lena, thank you very much. Okay, have a good day to everybody.